This is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
How do we know planet Earth really is warming? Well, partly because Dr. Phil D. Jones tracks temperature records from all over the world. Dr. Jones published hundreds of papers which are highly cited in climate science. For 20 years in the UK, he directed the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. Now he is professorial fellow in the School of Environmental Sciences at the university. Phil Jones, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
You were awarded your doctorate in hydrology in 1977, and only 3 years later you began your life's work of collecting temperature records from around the world. Why did you, as a young hydrologist, pick that up?
Well, at the time in 1977 when I finished my PhD, or just before even, I was looking for a job, and I had applied for a number of jobs in the hydrology area, but I also applied for one in the Climatic Research Unit and in at University of East Anglia in Norwich, and that was the one I got. And it was very fortuitous for me personally and for my career. It was a very good area to get into at that time.
And in your 2001 book, History and Climate, Memories of the Future, it surprised me to find that even up to the mid-1970s, shortly before you got on board, scientists thought that humans lived in a fairly fixed climate, you know, at least within our time frames. So even that recently, science had to shake off the medieval view of a never-ending stable cycle with minor variations. That seems strange to me now.
But there was a belief that climate, for all intents and purposes at that time, in around the late 1970s, 1980, could be thought of as constant. So we design things like river works in towns to stop flooding and dams to provide agriculture with water. We design them assuming that the year-to-year variations in climate were pretty much the same, and you could just assume that that was going to continue into the future. But there had been studies earlier, and going back to Fourier in France in the 1830s, but more recently in the 1890s by Svante Arrhenius in Sweden, that if you increased a number of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide is the main one, then you would increase the temperature of the planet. And a number of people have worked on that during the 20th century. The first temperature record was produced by Vladimir Kirpin in the 1870s and 1880s. And another record was produced by Guy Stewart Callender in Britain in 1938 and 1961. And he also looked at the reason for the temperature increase that even he saw in his 1938 paper from the late 19th century. And he related that to carbon dioxide increases. And he also produced a record of carbon dioxide from measurements we'd made from expeditions to various places around the world of carbon dioxide concentrations from the late 19th century to about 1940. And he could see that it was going up. And that record is in pretty good agreement with the record that was later produced from ice cores in Greenland and the Antarctic of carbon dioxide trapped in the bubbles of ice. So Callender did some amazing work. And in terms of the temperature work, you've got to bear in mind that he did it all by hand. I mean, what we can do now with digitized data and computers is we can calculate things amazingly quickly. But I think Callender, it probably took Callender a couple of years to put all the temperature data together to show that the world had warmed from the late 19th century to about 1940.
Well, let's step back a bit. I mean, what is temperature? What is the thermometer actually measuring?
Well, the thermometer is measuring air temperature is our main thing. You can obviously have thermometers measuring other things like the temperature of the sea, the temperature in lakes, etc. What most people were interested in the first part of the 20th century and even up to about 1980 was the temperature measured on land, which we refer to as air temperature, and it's measured in little sort of white-housed little huts, not small huts. They're called Stevenson screens. So they're designed to protect the thermometer from the direct rays of the sun, but just to measure the temperature of the air. So this screen has a louvred shield around it, so the air can circulate, and the thermometer can respond to the air. and not to the direct rays of the sun. The idea is that if you get enough of these together around the world, you will put together a global picture. And a lot of people thought at the time, during the 20th century up to the 1960s, that this wasn't that important because they were more interested in forecasting the day-to-day changes in the weather rather than this longer-term aspects of climate.
And do we now have a standard time map of temperature, say, since the 1870s?
Yeah, we do, from about 1850, in fact. And we have a number of different components of this. So, as I mentioned, there's the air temperatures over the land. But we realized fairly early on when we started in about 1980 that the land is only 30% of the surface of the Earth. So 70% is oceans. And you need to include a number of measurements of sea temperatures as well, the proxy for air temperatures, because there's not enough islands around the world. There's vast areas of the oceans without islands. So in order to get a true global picture, you need to bring together air temperatures measured on land and sea temperatures measured in the ocean surface, called sea surface temperatures, and they then are a proxy for the air temperature over the ocean.
What are some of the tools used to reconstruct temperature records before the invention of the thermometer in the early 1700s?
Well, one other bit that's interesting is how the records were taken in the 17th and 18th centuries. They're mainly in Europe, and they gradually extended to other parts of the world with European colonization of places. So records in North America might begin in the late 18th century, and maybe where you are, they begin about 1850. But in other parts of the world, like Africa, they only begin in the late 19th century because there's just not enough measurements made, particularly in the interior of Africa, until that time. Most of the observations in Africa and South America were around the coast. And that's also the case in parts of India and Australia as well. So Europe is unique in having these long records going back to the late 17th century and into the 18th century.
Well, that brings me to my next question, because you investigated the concepts embodied in the terms medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age. Phil Jones, how important were those events, and are they part of climate change?
Well, if you look back in Europe, you can go back to about 1700 with a number of temperature series. But that's only 300 years to the year 2000. So what we thought and realized, it would be good to try and extend temperatures back in time. And we wanted to find various proxy sources that were capable of doing this. And there are a number. We might come to discuss some of these, like trees, coral records in the tropics, ice cores in Greenland and the Antarctic. And there are other records from lake sediments and sea sediments that can provide different measures of temperature. But the important thing to remember with these records is that they're biological with trees, and they're sort of biological as well with corals. And when the snow falls in Greenland, they're measuring some measure of the temperature then, but they're not equivalent to thermometers. So they're not measuring temperature all the time. For example, trees are mainly responding to what happens in the summer months of the year, the spring and summer months, and they don't tell us anything about the winter months. And this is important because we know from the instrumental record for the last 150 years that, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, because of its greater land area, the winters have a much more variable from winter to winter than our summers from one summer to the next. So we try to put together records of past temperature reconstructed from these various types of natural proxies. We also have other proxies too, from where civilizations have written down things about the past. So these are mainly in Europe and China and Japan and Korea, where there's long written histories. So people can write things down about when rivers froze, when snow fell, how good the harvests were. And so they're year-to-year proxies in a comparable way to trees. But then they're all nowhere near as good as the instrumental data, which is telling you things about the days of the year, the months of the year, and not just one particular season. So when it comes to trying to piece all this together and look at the past, we really want to have records that can tell us things on the year-to-year timescale. And at the time of us doing some of this early work around the 1980 period, there had been concepts put forward about the pre-instrumental period. And one of these was the medieval period, say from about 950 AD to about 1250 or maybe 1300, was warmer than maybe later centuries, and that there was a period later from about 1550 to 1850 that was cooler than in the years in the 20th century. So the important thing to remember, though, is that these concepts came from work done in the 1960s or even earlier, when we had very little evidence about what was happening in the past. Now we have orders of magnitude more data than we had in the 1960s and 70s in terms of tree ring series, coral series, ice core series, documentary series, and the other proxies I've mentioned. So really, when we get all this extra data, the concepts we had of the past in the 1960s and 70s ought to gradually change with that new evidence. But even most paleoclimatologists who work with this data still use these terms, medieval warm period and little ice age, even though they're a bit pejorative in their terms, in that you obviously think the medieval warm period was somehow warmer and the little ice age was colder than some absolute level. But you've got to bear in mind that these records are not perfect like the instrumental data, and the medieval warm period appears to be a period in the medieval times which was relatively warm, but almost all the proxies are telling you things about the summer months of the year because it relates to crop yields, tree growth, etc. And the Little Ice Age is similar to some extent, but we do have a few more proxies for the winter months of the year from things like freezing of rivers and freezing of canals in the Netherlands that can give us a bit more of a clue to how winters varied in the past. So the medieval warm period and Little Ice Age are important periods, but I think they're overused because people seem to believe that because they're mostly proxies of summer, they are somehow proxies of the annual average. And the instrumental record tells us that that is not always the case. There are periods, even in the period from 1850 onwards, when you have very warm summers and you might have colder winters at the same time. And so the annual average is going to be, it's going to combine those two particular types of signal.
What are some of the problems of constructing a good temperature record for China?
Well, we always thought that there was good, we know that there's good records in China. There's obviously the long documentary series that I was talking about earlier, and this does have records back for over 1,000 years, and a few places have records beyond that in the various dynastic records. And one of the things of using them is you've got to make sure that they are telling you, well, different people in different centuries are telling you the same thing about what they're measuring. So, for example, if they're measuring some yields of crops, it might be that the crop variety has changed slightly over time, and that is sort of hidden within those different observers who will have a typical human lifespan of maybe 50 years at that time. So what someone would say about the crop yield in the 13th century might be different from what someone would say in the 18th century. So you've got to bear in mind that although it might be good on the year-to-year timescale in terms of good years and bad years for harvests, might be less good on the century timescale when you're looking at different centuries hundreds of years apart. And this is why the winter records of freezing of rivers, etc., are very good, because freezing occurs at a fixed temperature, 0 degrees Celsius. So we know that humans a long time ago would have noticed the same thing that humans would notice now if a particular river froze or a canal froze.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my special guest, Dr. Phil D. Jones from the University of East Anglia, where he directed the Climatic Research Unit for 20 years, Phil is an authority on temperature records. Well, let's return to Europe, Phil. Was there really a Dark Ages cold period back in, say, the years 500 or 600 AD? And was the primitive state of governments and culture in Europe during the Dark Ages perhaps a reflection of a climatic period?
Well, when we look back over Europe, we have obviously the long instrumental records, and this enables us to look at the proxy records in a much longer calibration period, if you think of it that way. So we can look at trees growing from 1750 to 1950. So 200 years of tracking the trees and tracking the temperatures. Whereas in other parts of the world, that overlap is considerably shorter and generally less than about 100 years. So we have a number of long records, though, in Europe, and particularly in the more northern parts of Europe, where the trees are dominant in terms of they're providing reconstructions. It's not to say that trees in southern Europe don't provide reconstructions, but because it's warmer in the Mediterranean areas, the trees there are responding more to changes in moisture from year to year as the temperature is warm enough. Whereas in Scandinavia and northern Russia, the trees are responding to temperatures because that's the main limiting factor to their growth. Whereas in the Mediterranean, it's precipitation amounts. And we have a number of potential reconstructions from trees going back several millennia in northern Sweden and northern Finland, and also in northwestern Russia as well. And in looking at these many years ago, we noticed that there were, in the 6th century, there were two really narrow years in 536 and 542. And we believe that these are typical signature years from very cold temperatures during the summer, which come in Europe often after severe volcanic eruptions. For example, there's Krakatoa, and there's another big eruption in 1258 and 1601. So these years tend to lead to very cold summers in northern Europe. And in the 6th century, there were tended to be more volcanic eruptions in this century than in centuries before, as you go back towards the Roman times. And there were other eruptions in the 7th and 8th centuries as well. So when we're looking at this, you're looking at the factors that might influence the climate. So obviously one of those is the sun. The sun's output does vary. But also, if you have a large volcanic eruptions putting dust in the upper parts of the atmosphere, this then cools the surface and leads to these severe effects for 3 or 4 years after major volcanic eruptions. And so if you have more volcanic eruptions in certain centuries than others, then you will get sort of periods that appear cooler over a longer time frame of maybe 50 years to 100 years than other centuries which have hardly any volcanic eruptions. So this Dark Ages cold period is named because of it's in the Dark Ages period, which is the period after Rome collapsed in Italy and moved to Constantinople. But we believe that a number of major volcanic eruptions occurred in the 6th century, and there were a few more in the 7th century. This is why this period's become known as the Dark Ages cold period, because of these volcanic eruptions. And we can see more volcanic eruptions later during the Little Ice Age period, from about 1550 to 1850. And we can also see fewer volcanic eruptions during the medieval period, from about 950 to 1250. So maybe the medieval period was slightly warmer because there were fewer volcanic eruptions, and the Little Ice Age was cooler, and the Dark Ages cold period was also cooler because of more volcanic eruptions. But this is just one theory. We also know that solar output was potentially greater during the medieval period than it was in later centuries from some of the long reconstructions of solar output that have been speculatively produced.
Well, over the last 35 or more years, you've published over 400 papers, and you have a really global and wide-ranging nature to your research. In 2017, for example, you co-authored a paper on wildfires in Borneo. What is the difference, then, between a climatic drought and a hydrological drought? Aren't they both just caused by lack of rain or snow?
In principle, yes. But there's also a meteorological drought. There's another definition, which is the lack of rainfall for 30 or 40 days in northern Europe. A lot of these definitions come from northern Europe and maybe parts of North America, and they're less applicable in other parts of the world where you have a more climate in terms of in the tropics, particularly of rainy seasons and wet seasons. So in terms of a climate drought and a hydrological drought, these two are not that different, but they're also bringing into the mix the changes in evaporation as well. So drought isn't just the lack of precipitation. It's often exacerbated by the clear skies and the warm temperatures that go along with the lack of precipitation in many parts of the world. So if you combine the precipitation amounts and the evaporation amounts, then you get an idea of the sort of water balance, and that's more of a hydrological drought. And that's what we were doing in that paper in Borneo, is that when there's more hydrological droughts, when there's less rain and higher temperatures, then you have more potential fuel available on the ground to start fires in this part of the world, in Borneo, not deliberately, but by thunderstorms and lightning.
And some of those smoke fires were tremendous. They went all, as far as Malaysia in recent years, yes.
Some of the ones in recent years have, what the ones here in Borneo are more naturally started. But some of the smoke that went over Malaysia and Singapore from Indonesia are often from humans burning the forests to clear the forests of native vegetation in order to plant palm trees. So it's a clearance effect in Sumatra and maybe parts of Java as well.
Sadly, Phil, this year you had to help write a memoriam to your colleague Keith R. Briefa. Tell us about the man and why his work matters.
Well, this was a shock to me when he died a couple of years ago in October 2017, because I'd shared an office with him for 25 years, so you get to know someone very well in that sort of you're working together. Keith had been working principally on the tree rings, and he'd done a lot of initiatives in how to process tree ring data to ensure that you had this good year-to-year agreement between the trees, and you'd removed all the biological influences of growth trends. So trees, long-lived trees, do gradually put on smaller rings as the rings get more on the edge of the disc of a tree growth. And Keith was one of the main people who has written a number of key papers that are still used today by dendroclimatologists to look at trees, first of all, how well they agree with one another, then ensuring that they're principally looking at past temperatures or past precipitation events. And I think if you look at his papers, you'll find that virtually every tree ring paper written today will refer to two or three of his papers, because people are still using the concepts that he developed during the 1980s and 1990s and extended during his career until his untimely death in 2017.
And we also recently lost in February the American scientist Wallace Smith Brocher, the man credited with coining the term global warming. And he also established a great knowledge about the ocean conveyor belt. In his last message to scientists, at a group of scientists at the University of Arizona, Wally Brocher called for more research quickly into geoengineering to shade the planet. Phil, do you think we're approaching such a dire need, and what do you think about it?
I met Wally a couple of times. He's a charming man, very, very knowledgeable man, and I'm often asked about this same sort of question about the climate's changing and what are we going to do about it. And obviously the things we've got to do are to reduce the amounts of carbon dioxide and methane entering the atmosphere. So we've got to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and replace that with renewables and probably also nuclear power initially. But in terms of Wally's ideas about doing something more positive, doing something more...
Proactive. Let's call it proactive.
A proactive way in trying to cool the planet by putting enough sort of material in the upper atmosphere, sort of putting up there a sort of constant volcano to reduce the amount of radiation reaching the surface, which would cool the planet. Now, the problem with this idea is, in theory, it's a good thing. But we know from the volcanic examples that although the volcanoes go off in different parts of the world, and we're talking particularly here about tropical volcanoes, their effects are more global in scale, but they're not always in the same place, the effects, I mean, of where the cooling occurs. And I'm sure that if we started doing this, we probably would cool the planet down slowly. It's going to take a long time. But then you will have people saying that you have caused some different sorts of extremes in terms of droughts or floods or heat waves and cold spells, and that you've got to somehow, someone would have to take the blame for those. And is that the sort of science of the world or the governments of the world who've initiated these schemes to try and cool the planet with a sort of continual volcano? It also assumes that we know fully what's going to happen in the future in terms of temperature change. if we continue to burn fossil fuels. We know the temperature is going to go up, but do we know how much it's going to go up and go up where? It might go up much more in the polar regions, for example, than the tropics. But in order to look at this effect of trying to cool the planet proactively, I think we don't know enough in order to put that scheme forward and be confident with the outcome we're going to get. I mean, we have, in effect, had a sort of proactive experiment going on with the burning of fossil fuels, and we're now going to then try another proactive experiment with putting dust in the atmosphere to cool the planet. And I think we need to know more about the first one, which was inadvertent, before we go to the second one.
Many of us will not live to see the dangerous inheritance we leave to coming generations. In a strange way, I'm almost disappointed. I may not live to see climate science fully vindicated or society acting to save itself. Does that bother you, Phil Jones?
It doesn't bother me that much because I know that I'm 66, so I haven't got too many more years on this planet. But I know that my grandchildren have, and I know that my children and my grandchildren are going to have to take responsibility at some point for what we've done as a generation and what previous generations have done in increasing the average temperature of the world and making some areas less habitable than others. So I think there's going to have to be a lot of work done in the future, and it's got to be done in a competent way, like I was talking about earlier with the proactive ways, so that we really know what we're doing. We've got to follow it through with modeling studies, observational studies, etc., and we've got to be monitoring the planet continually in the future, improving our understanding of how the climate works so that we can then follow through within the models as to what we're doing and what is happening and whether it's going on with how we expected it to go on. But one thing I feel very interested about recently is that there's a number of groups in different parts of Europe and the Americas and Australia and maybe other countries where younger people are realizing that this is going to be a massive problem for them in their lifetimes. And these school strikes trying to raise interest amongst the politicians who have the ability to do something. So I think it's really positive with these children, and started by this Swedish child, it's really positive that they are going to push this agenda, and maybe the governments of the world will take notice. It's clear that some government leaders are taking no notice whatsoever and think they know everything. But I think there's going to be a few surprises along the way. And I wish I was 40 years younger and I could see more of it, like you were saying, but I'm not. But I think it's going to be a greater and greater interest amongst scientists in the future. And so I would recommend anyone who's of school age, that this is a fantastic career to have got into, that I got into inadvertently in 1977. And it's going to be a very important continuing career in future decades.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. From the University of East Anglia, we have been talking with Dr. Phil Jones, professorial fellow at the School of Environmental Sciences at the University of East Anglia. And as you can see from this interview, much more over his long career. Phil, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.